Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. During our hour, we're going to be defining fascism as a continuation of our in-depth series on the topic. We're going to look at the interpretation of government and private industry and the failures of democratic radicalism in preventing the U.S. from descending into fascism. Today, my guest is Professor Norman Pollack. Professor Pollack is Professor Emeritus of History at Michigan State University in East Lansing. He has a long history of engaging in civil rights and anti-war activities over the decades, beginning when he was 15 and campaigning for Henry Wallace and his Progressive Party in 1948. Later, he campaigned for Adlai Stevenson in the 1950s and supported Martin Luther King. A two-time Guggenheim Fellow, Professor Pollack was a major intellectual voice during the late 1960s in giving an acknowledgeable boost to the New Left in writing on American populism, which became a documentary called The Populist Mind. After receiving his doctorate in American Civilization from Harvard, he taught at Yale and Wayne State University, and in recent years he's focused on the history of civil disobedience, social-political alienation, and the sociology of fascism. He currently writes for Counterpunch and looking at the identifying characteristic of America's descent into a new form of neoliberal fascist state. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary. That I can't really... That introduction floors me. A lot of it's past memory. I can only add to that that quite a bit later, after age 15, I had a wonderful time with Henry Wallace and went to his farm in South Salem, New York, and wanted to do the biography. And the only thing that scared me away was that this was a fellow who had a remarkably strong scientific and mathematical background. We saw that in his hybridization of corn, but in a general way, and the way he was portrayed by Schlesinger and others as this pie-in-the-sky guy, I just felt I couldn't do justice to the kind of empirical research that I feel was necessary to bring that dimension out. But he was a marvelous person.
I'm glad that you gave a little attention to him, because most people today would not know who he was, what he stood for.
Oh, there is a... I'm running into this all the time. It's not so much a memory loss. It's almost as though so much of very solid work has just dropped over the horizon or something. And I guess I'm one of those, maybe for selfish reasons, who feels that... It was really in that period of the mid-50s up until around maybe 1970 that so much very fundamental work was being done in the area of social theory and the like. And none of that is known. We're sort of reinventing the wheel and doing a pretty lousy job of it.
I would agree. Today we're going to talk about a topic that rarely, if ever, is discussed in the mainstream, or for that matter, even the alternative media. And I say the alternative media because there are many programs and popular programs on the left, but when you examine how far they go, they stay away from that third rail of fascism, because in many respects, they're really nothing more than corporate Democrats or corporate liberals, like Clinton and many of the people on NPR. And many of the programs that are sponsored on PBS by major corporations. So we're going to tie some things together. For example, here are some major stories from Counterpunch and from Global Research and Common Dreams, and even yesterday's front page New York Times. Now, there's an article entitled "For Medical Tourist," and I'll put it this way. They show a graph. To get a hospital room for 3 nights in the United States, no treatment, just a bed in a hospital, is $8,050. For in Belgium, a better room for 11 nights, $3,000. If you want an implant in the United States, $36,000. In Belgium, $4,000. And a surgeon's fee, the average surgeon fee in the United States is $17,000. In Belgium, it's $11,000. $100. And then it talks about a hip in the United States, have it replaced, is $78,000. In Belgium, it's $13,000. And yet you're going to get better care, better quality, less infection in not only Belgium, but many other countries. Now, later we'll revisit that. And why is that connected to fascism? Also, an article on a Haitian sweatshop worker speaks, quote, Mrs. Clinton can have her factories. Another Haitian article about how the United States and its corporate elite are rewriting Haiti's constitution so that they can better serve the 1%. A climate change journalist, a reporter who wanted to blow the whistle from Reuters, was told, don't write about climate change. Another article, Monsanto seeks control over the world's food supply. Pete Dalek wrote an article, it's not science fiction anymore, about how one corporation has more control over what we eat than any other corporation in history. That's still part of fascism. Money laundering from the Global Research. Money laundering and the global drug trade are fueled by capitalist elites. That's about fascism. And also, Obama gives himself control over all communication systems in the United States. And one last one, the shocking things the FBI has done since 9/11. Now, go through these quickly. The U.S. Patriot Act, they've abused it. The 2008 amendments to the Attorney General's guidelines, they rewrote them in order to make it easier for them to spy on over 82,000 people who had no background of criminal activity or terrorist activity at all, just gave them the right to go in and spy on people. Racial and ethnic mapping, unrestrained data collection and data mining, suppressing internal dissent. I don't know if most people are aware of this, but the FBI does not have the rights of whistleblowers of other agencies of government, even though there is a Whistleblower Protection Act. They ignore it, and if any employee of the FBI ever wants to blow the whistle, you are aggressively investigated and pursued. Targeting journalists, the FBI has an overzealous approach to going after any journalist. Thwarting congressional oversight, targeting First Amendment activity, and proxy detentions. Those are some of the ways that the United States FBI has engaged in what I would call fascist interests, because behind this, it's not just politics. It's corporate interest. Now, I lay that out, as I do with all these programs, to show that even the unintended consequences of fascism impacts us in ways that we would never imagine. Now, that said, I'm going to give a little extensive introduction to the question I'd like you to address, all right?
Okay. Is there time just for a quick comment on what you did say?
Yes.
Okay. First off, what I very much appreciate in what you said is the recognition that all of these things are not isolated events or developments, but that what one has here is really an interrelated core of policy. For example, one reason I jumped off the boat on Obama very early was that with the health care discussions, it was clear that he had sabotaged not simply the single-payer system, but the public option as well. He suspended or rejected antitrust prosecution possibilities against health insurers, did many, many things. And that sort of told me, as I believe it tells you from your examples, that what one does here is merely begin to make inroads into a much larger complex or context. And I think that interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act is a beautiful example of where the government deliberately prevents any kind of actionable or any kind of activity that would expose so many things, including war crimes themselves. So sure, I'm right with you on that, so please go ahead.
Okay, and I was going to come to it later. I'll just do it now since you opened that door. I'll show you just a slightly different interpretation of how I read this. When the Congress was passing the Medicare act. It was passed in the middle of the night, about 3 o'clock. No one had read it. It was over 1,100 pages long, and every single word had been written by a group of lobbyists representing big pharma, big hospitals, and big insurance companies. And they specifically excluded the governmental agencies such as Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans hospitals from securing the least expensive or what is called the generic drugs. Had they done that, we would have been saving about $250 billion a year, or over $1 trillion to date. Instead, we have to pay on some drugs, because we got the actual statistics from their generic 30-day counterpart, as many as 60,000% markup. So now when a person complains, gee whiz, why is it that our medicines are so expensive? Why does it cost 1,700% more in the United States than it does in another country to get a particular procedure? It's because the private interests at the major corporate level work with federal government agencies in secret to draft legislation that protected one at the cost of another. And therefore, that is true across so many issues. Now, that said, let me give you one more.
Please, go ahead.
I have a lot of concern about any corporation that has the right to patent a terminator seed, meaning it can only grow once and never again, since the vast majority of the people in the world that are farmers save seeds for the following season.
Sure.
I'm also concerned that we have had worldwide what is called colony collapse disorder, where major beehives collapse. Now, it is not the organic beehives. I'm an organic certified farmer. I also am a beekeeper. I have 40 hives and have my adult life. It is the ones that are used with sprays, and they're specific sprays that have been banned by the European Food Safety Authority, and because they know that clothiodinin is completely unacceptable for human use. They banned it entirely, yet we use it because Monsanto and others like Bayer and DuPont have the power to control the selection of the director, of the head of the USDA, the head of food safety for the FDA, Michael Taylor, who used to come from and was a lawyer for Monsanto, and they have paid the lobbyists who then insert themselves in the political process to make sure that anything involving food is ultimately determined by the manufacturers of these seeds. Now, here's a simple fact. Now, this is a terrible idea that most people are not aware of. Here are the plants that are pollinated by bees. So if we lose a single crop or it's diminished, and in some cases we have 90% bee collapse in some major aviaries, here's where you're at. Apples, mangoes, kiwi, plums, peaches, nectarines, guava, rosehip, pomegranate, pears, black and red currants, alfalfa, okra, strawberries, onions, cashews, cactus, prickly pear, apricots, allspice, avocado, passion fruit, lima beans, kidney beans, adduki beans, green beans, custard apples, cherry, celery, walnuts, cotton, lychee, flax, acerola, macadamia nuts, sunflower, lemons, buckwheat, figs, fennel, limes, quince, carrots, persimmons, loquat, cucumbers, hazelnut, cantaloupe, tangelos, coriander, cardamom, chestnut, watermelon, star apples, coconut, tangerines, boysenberry, star fruit, Brazil nuts, beets, mustard seed, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, bok choy, turnips, sword beans, chili peppers, papaya, sesame, eggplant, raspberry, elderberry, black berries, clover, tamarind, cocoa, black walnuts, vanilla, cranberries, tomatoes, and grapes, all would cease to exist. So on the one hand, we don't think about this. It's not in our consciousness. But when you have a pesticide, and that pesticide is toxic, and it's not being used all around the world, but used here, and that causes the bees to collapse, and the bees then cannot pollinate. Without pollination, you're not going to get those crops. Think of how that would impact us, and yet not a discussion anywhere about the unintended consequences of that power elite. Your thoughts, please.
My thoughts, first of all, I'll start by disagreeing in one sense, and that would be that I don't regard the consequences as unintended. It's not that I addicted to conspiracy theory or impute malevolence, but I think that whenever this occurs, the people involved have full knowledge of the consequences of their actions, and yet they persist in going ahead. So I wouldn't give them even the benefit of the doubt about an unintended consequence. But listening to you, Gary, what I was sensing, and I feel this very strongly, it may sound a little bit flowery to say it this way, but that our whole civilization is experiencing a qualitative change. And this qualitative change really doesn't have parallel with the past in terms of what I think I've been centering on, which is that relationship between business and government, and how by business enjoying the protection of the state and the favoritism, the partiality of the state, business is then free to be totally unrestrained in doing whatever it takes to, among other things, I guess, maximize profits, but even more, to stabilize an entire system that will ensure its continuance along the lines that have been set up. So that what I was playing around with this morning, I just wrote a piece that I just sent off a few moments ago to Counterpunch, entitled "Toward a Definition of Fascism: America, Monopoly Capital, and Advanced Industrialism." And it seems to me that what really is happening is industrialism can be a highly dynamic force, and I think it would be silly to want to curb technological innovation and things of this kind as such. But what happens is that that dynamic force then becomes encased in a highly static societal framework, what you might call the old order itself, so that you really have this tremendous kind of not simply friction between the two, but the guidance on the part of the established order as to what that technology will do, how it will then be utilized. And the overall point, it seems to me, is anything to prevent the democratization of the society itself. So that whether you're looking at medicine, whether you're looking at agriculture, whether you're looking at banking regulation, et cetera, it's almost as though one were, and again, I'm sorry for the labels, but as though one were in a kind of counter-revolutionary phase, which ensures that capitalism will completely go ahead in its process of concentration, monopolization, and at the same time not be molested by anything, whether social critics or popular demonstrations or what have you, so that it becomes what they used to call in the 1920s, and I think it's a good label, a business commonwealth. And a business commonwealth would be essentially a state within the state, and a state that calls the signals, but in fact is not all that powerful unless it enjoys the protection of the larger state. So that you really have this kind of sweetheart relationship between government and business. And for me, as that progresses, and as capitalism itself gets more mature, more demanding, runs into more and more problems, I think in our own case, we're almost at a stage of senescence here, senility, in that it's getting harder and harder to keep things directly on course, which means, therefore, adopt methods more and more extreme to ensure that the stabilization holds. You see it now with the way labor unions have been pretty well messed up. You see it, I can't really say I know anything about the FDA, but from what I can gather there, what I can gather from Interior with all of this permits being handed out left and right by Salazar for drilling on public lands, the entire Keystone thing. I mean, don't get me going, and I don't want to get you going, but believe me, there are so many things, and they seem to me to become increasingly integrated, and integrated in a way that not only does it not bode too well for the society, but that it seems to me it really refutes any idea that the Democratic Party has any kind of authentic progressive dimension.
I appreciate that insight. That is very well tuned to what we need to hear. And clearly you have contemplated this issue extensively. And right now, we're witnessing the U.S. government's full allegiance to Wall Street firms and multinational corporations, widespread high-tech surveillance of every America, militarized police enforcement, drone surveillance over domestic cities and regions, austerity measures against citizens, making them believe it is in the interest of the nation that they be supervised, the growth of the indigenous neo-fascist organizations and groups that are racist, nationalist, authoritarian, and religiously mythological at their core, and finally, the rise of a powerful political elite that support these policies and want to institutionalize them. And so before we go forward, I'd like to share a short list of fascism's defining characteristics to see if you would agree with these or not, because today I believe that we are bearing witness to powerful and increasing expressions of nationalism and disdain for the importance of human rights, which are perceived as having little value over the objectives of a ruling elite, and identification of enemies as a unifying cause for citizens to rally behind. Think of Fox, think of Bill O'Reilly. The supremacy of the military and an avid militarism to solve all of our problems. Rampant racism and sexism that views minorities and women as second-class citizens in order to favor professional male superiority in decision-making, and also controlled mass media, which include regime control of licensing and economic pressures on media outlets, obsession with national security under the control of a ruling elite, and the government protection of corporate interests, as you've mentioned, and also the suppression of labor unions, the disdain and suppression of intellectuals and the arts, or in short, the suppression of inherent freedom of ideas, the obsession of crime and punishment leading to draconian systems of criminal justice, the rampant cronyism and corruption among the ruling elite, and fraudulent elections where people buy their elections. And most of these defining characteristics we have witnessed also historically in Nazi Germany and Italy and during Pinochet's regime in Suharto's and Indonesia and other fascist regimes. So I'd like you to pick up on any of these defining traits and elaborate on them as predominantly displayed today. And also just think of Benito Mussolini. He had a great deal to say about defining fascism, and he said fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. And the definition of fascism is the marriage of corporation and state. And we have buried the putrid corpse of liberty. And socialism is a fraud, a comedy, and a phantom, and a blackmail. All this was said by Mussolini, but I see it being used today to interpret the relationship between government and private business. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Okay. Gary, let me just sort of start with several of the things that you just said. This afternoon was writing about, including Mussolini's corporatism and various things. Let me start with this. There was one person whose work influenced me very much, who, of course, since it was late 1930s when he wrote, he won't be remembered, Robert A. Brady, who was a Columbia University economist. And he wrote two books, The Spirit and Structure of German Fascism and Business as a System of Power. Perfect, really right on target. What he did in The Spirit and Structure was simply this. He took policy statements from the NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, and the Chamber of Commerce, put them into boxes, into columns, and in parallel columns, I think on the same page or the facing page, he had quotations from the Nazi front organizations. Now, a front organization was essentially like our trade association. It was the organization of business into fronts. And when you looked at the columns, they were not simply congruent, but the language is almost identical. And there's no question but that large-scale business in the United States really looked fondly at what was going on in Nazi Germany at that time. And in terms of the corporatism, the term itself really does hit the nail on the head, because what it is really trying to say is that the state and the corporation, or the corporations collectively, are inseparable, and therefore that it is the obligation, even let's say the moral obligation of the state to advance the interests of the corporations. So with that in mind, and given a world context, at least in those days, and perhaps to some extent in our day, of capitalist rivalries and rivalries in general in terms of trade and market penetration and capital flows and all that kind of stuff, what this means is that the state is really obligated to develop war planning, one of the things I strongly oppose in Obama is the so-called pivot, and the pivot is using the military resources that had previously been located in Europe and in the Near East and sending them over to the Pacific, developing a Pacific first strategy, and with that in mind, really attempting the containment and ultimately the isolation of China, which is a very dangerous game. And interestingly enough, it's like a resumption of the Cold War with now a new target. Things are not going well between the U.S. and Russia for reasons that I think go well beyond Snowden, but I truly, truly am happy at what Snowden is doing, because he's bringing out into the open what those sub-rosa tensions are by the way the U.S. is trying to bully everybody and demand his, whatever you call it, repatriation or something like that. But this confrontation with China, and so you've got that. You've got what you were calling nationalism. And the thought that occurred to me today is that I think I've got a better word for it, that it really is the same thing, but it's a special kind of nationalism, and that's this idea of autarky. And autarky is really very much along the lines of what the United States has pursued in foreign policy for really almost, well, at least since World War II, and that is that attempt at the unilateral structuring of global political and economic relationships. Everything is unilateral. Of course, we have the so-called friends and allies, in quotes, who we need for interventionist activities, essentially the same way we have private contractors like Blackwater going out there, and in both cases paying a handsome sum to these guys. But the United States is almost willfully alone in the world in attempting some kind of, I won't call it domination, it sounds a little too strong, let's say dominance. That dominance is political, it's economic, it's psychological, it's ideological, and this is where I feel the system is showing its strains, and the very fact that the performance is so poor as compared, say, with China, the very fact that we've extended this outsourcing and have gone through this whole episode of exotic financial instruments and things like that indicates to me that there is a certain desperation which is taking an increasingly military form. I could pick up on some of the other items on the list, but I agree with them completely. And I think they're all pointing. I try to make clear to myself, one of the first things I ever wrote for Counterpunch, which was only about a year ago, I called it the cusp of fascism, because I'm not prepared just to put out the label as such at this point. What I see instead is, I hate to play around, you know, because it's not, it's sort of intellectually dishonest. I hate to play around with words, but it's really a disposition toward fascism. It's moving closer and closer into that framework. And I, for the life of me, can't say why it isn't so. And I think one of the mistakes we're making is simply to always work with the analogy of Nazi Germany. And my own sense is that something like the concentration camp in and of itself does not exhaust or get at the meaning of fascism. That fascism is, with or without a concentration camp, is the clear degradation of the working class, the degradation of the poor. In our case, the way we're totally, what would the word be, but cutting into that the social safety net as a very vengeful kind of thing, all in this case for the sake of more armaments. But the model that occurred to me, and I'd like, you know, people to think about this a little, is a different kind of fascism, or at least fascism and its relation to capitalism in the way that I think corresponds to our own, and that is Japan. And in Japan, what you see is a very clear structure of these highly concentrated industries and so on, and at the same time enjoying, in this case, really formal protection. We saw this mess with Temco and the Fukushima explosions and things like that. But there's a guy who I also read when I was much younger, who I would, you know, recommend to anyone listening, a very distinguished Japanese political scientist by the name of Masao Maruyama. And Masao Maruyama, describing almost exactly what we could be describing here with interpenetration of business and government, simply called it a close embrace system, a close embrace system. And it seems to me that really does bring about that synthesis, and that synthesis which then permits both the state and capitalism to feed off of each other. This may surprise you, but this is the vision of Theodore Roosevelt, the guy who claimed to have been, or at least popular, you know, whatever, history books thought of him as a trust buster. This is the first real foundation for interpenetration. And Roosevelt, who knew what he was, you know, thinking, said what we must have is a consolidated economic base, which is to say monopolism, in order to develop that kind of global military power that will give us whatever, all the, you know, the markets in the world, the advantages of the power, and so on. And that whole vision has been pretty well, almost, let's say, continuously refined or developed. Wilson with his Federal Reserve System. We know the Federal Reserve System now. We know that it is not a regulatory tool to curb banking excesses. We know that it's staffed directly from the banking community, all of these things. And yet there's this persistence in the folklore that somehow regulation regulates. Regulation does not regulate. Regulation protects those who are supposed to be regulated and allows them to then have free room to expand and concentrate still further.
I would. Okay. I really appreciate these insights and the nuance on the concept. I think that for a moment we should look at George Orwell, because he wrote an essay entitled Notes on Nationalism. Mm-hmm. In it, he said that by nationalism, I first mean all of the habit of assuming that human beings can be classified like insects, and that the whole block of millions or tens of millions of people can be confidently labeled either good or bad. But secondly, and this is much more important, I mean the habit of identifying oneself with a single nation or other unit, placing it beyond good and evil, and recognizing no other duty than that of advancing its interest. And then there is the same essay. Orwell said the abiding purpose of every nationalist is to secure more power and more prestige, not for himself, but for the nation or other unit in which he has chosen to sink his own individuality. Nationalism is power-hungry, tempered by self-deception. Now, when we look back at history, we find fascism deeply tied to nationalist ideals. And looking back at the Bush administration, now during Obama's term, how is the rhetoric of nationalism being used in order to enable government and corporate fascists to gain greater control over the political process and the electorate?
That's okay. My answer to that is probably not going to be whatever, not going to be in agreement with anyone else's, but I think the single word that is suffocating everything is counterterrorism. And I see counterterrorism essentially as a way to bring about that surveillance, that massive surveillance, to in effect, the way you were describing the insight of Orwell, one of the things that makes for fascism, it seems to me, would be the depersonalization of the individual. And that in a way, what's happening with counterterrorism, some people are probably a little bit afraid of what are they going to say to their friends? What are they sending off in their emails? What are they writing? What's going where? And the way that the government, and whenever we say government, I wish we would simply say Obama, as a way of pinning down accountability, because it's his Department of Justice that is constantly abridging civil liberties. It's crazy. A law authority that is acting unlawfully, and Holder is just a nice extension of Obama on these things. But yeah, so basically, there is this. These things come together so well. The secrecy is for Obama, it's really an obsession. And the first thing I thought of about secrecy is, why the secrecy? What have you got to hide? If you had a government that was operating democratically, why would you need secrecy in the first place? And so basically, it seemed to me the first thing was that he was hiding his own war crimes. And his own war crimes, to me, meant specifically because it served symbolically and it focused things so nice, so well for me, was this armed drone for targeted assassination. A president of the United States sitting on Terror Tuesdays with his national security advisors and John Brennan at that time and whoever's there now and
Clapper
and Bill and Rhodes and all of these guys with their baseball cards, their hit list, the president authorizing the actual assassination of individuals, and then the execution of this itself pretty messed up, where you have the CIA working with private contractors, you have signature strikes that this is something where you target funerals because the assumption is that the people at the funerals are friends of the one you want to target, and then you target first responders because they're coming to the aid of people who have been massacred. And so basically, you're dealing with people. I mean, it's so I can't even describe it, but it's like the vaporization of the individual. And there was this Stanford NYU study, which is very, very good. And I think it was there that the phrase blood spat was used. That's what's left when a missile from one of these drones hits somebody. So here is, I wondered, how does this guy sleep at night? And my sense is he sleeps very well because his moral temperature is about zero, if not below zero. And so when you get back to the idea of fascism, I don't know if I'll write the book. Counterpunch has been advertising it as a way of coaxing me, but my working title was Eichmann on the Potomac. And
oh wow, that's a good title.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know. I mean, because it was meant to be really just about the drone warfare, but I can't keep up. I mean, nobody can. Every day, there's another abridgment. There's another violation. There's another thing going on. We promised to let go of the armed drones, and I think it was Mazzetti and whoever was writing in the Times a day or two ago, more drone strikes in Pakistan, more this, more that, an increase in Yemen. And when I say autarky and going it alone, what I think I really mean is that we're on our own behalf, with our own actions, we are becoming a pariah nation. that others, the surveillance did not go over well in Europe. And I don't see how it could go over well any place but the United States, where we're so darn completely, what would the word be, narcotized, acclimated to repression, that we wouldn't know repression if it hit us, you know, on the street corner.
Well, I certainly have a lot of thoughts that you just raised, and I'd like to explore those a little more. Many journalists and political analysts and historians are now writing that America's experiment with democracy is turning into a failure. And I'm most impressed with Morris Berman's trilogy of books on this subject. He uses the argument of La Longue Durée, that was the basis of the Annales school of French historians, such as Fernand Bruandel,
mm-hmm.
which argues that we need to analyze the structures that underlie contemporary historical events in order to observe the persistence of older attitudes of thought and action that often defy the logic of what is being demanded to deal with current problems. And when I look at how we are being corporately governed by Washington today, including teabaggers and birthers with no intellectual wriggle or stature whatsoever being elected into office. And I feel we need to be deeply concerned about the complete collapse of America's real democracy and the emergence of a very real authoritarian police state, far worse than the proto-police state we are in right now. Your thoughts on this, and also add into that your thoughts on Obama's National Defense Authorization Act, how that was not immediately challenged by the entire Democratic process just amazes me. And also, he can theoretically classify any citizen as a terrorist by simply dissenting from Washington's stance. And what are your thoughts about where the U.S. is headed as far as the executive branch increasing its stranglehold on power and privilege to murder and spy domestically and internationally, wage unprovoked wars, and also this whole National Intelligence Agency surveillance of all Americans? Because once you start one of these agencies, or once you fund one of these private corporations, it never diminishes. It just expands like a metastasizing tumor on the body politic. Your thoughts, please.
Oh, gosh. Gary, I used that. I don't even think I can say the word, but metastasizing, I used in one of my articles yesterday or the day before, and that's the same sense of the cancer is spreading. It is definitely spreading. The way legal memos presumably justifying practices are themselves kept secret, the way the FISA court has its decisions kept secret, all of this is the most flagrant kind of what would the word be, thumbing one's nose at the rule of law. And what I think is important here is you don't have to be a radical to see this, that an authentic conservative, and I'm thinking now of some of the, I haven't kept up, but I think that Ron Paul, not Rand, but Ron Paul, has really raised questions about privacy, conscience, and so on, that the older, there was a segment of conservative thought that had a great deal of power to it because of respect for the dignity of the individual. And this has been so run roughshod over. And I hold, you mentioned a bunch of things, Tea Party, and we can add Republican intransigence, all of that. My own feeling is that no, that if that the real responsibility or blame or what have you lies with the Democratic Party, lies with its whole structure of leadership, not just compromises it's made, but I assume that that secrecy itself is that transparent government is what is a sine qua non of democracy. You can't have democracy and have this kind of opaqueness. You can't have democracy and have the kind of closed system and hounding of dissidents and everything else that is going on. You know, if we start this, you're going to start getting me to believe that we're closer than even I thought But basically, there's too much of a I won't say an unprecedented nature, but my feeling is, for example, if one compares Obama and Bush, A, I think there are very genuine continuities between the two. But B, I hold that Obama is more dangerous than Bush, in part because what he has done is intensify the intensification of the policies of his predecessor. And what passes for his sophistication is really a sophistication that to me represents or resembles much more of cunning than intelligence. And I think basically, although I don't care about individual psychological interpretations of the president, things of that kind, although I've probably played with it myself, but basically there is here I don't know how to say it, but that he's not anyone's puppet. It's so easy to say the military has his wing, bankers have his ear. I'm sorry, bankers have his ear. Things of that kind. As far as I can see, he from the very beginning, and possibly going back to the exposure at the University of Chicago, was a guy who believed in market fundamentalism. Was a guy who had his nose pressed to the window, wanting to be part of some kind of elite structure. And what I've been saying is, and I know this sounds harsh, and I don't know if it's fair to say over the air, but in my most recent published Counterpunch piece, I think he is a traitor to the black race. And I base that on my own very strong connection and feelings about Paul Robeson, A. Philip Randolph, Thurgood Marshall, none of whom would have such a callous disregard for social justice. And I felt it was not unreasonable, given the centuries of exploitation directed to blacks, that the first black president should, I know maybe, I don't know, I think the first black president should have been a real champion of social justice. And he's been the opposite. And when I think of Dr. King, because I was fortunate enough to have had fairly close contact with him on a number of demonstrations, and I know what he went through. I've seen the terror in his eyes when I was up close, when we were in dangerous situations, things of that kind. But the point being, here's John Lewis, who was a well-known, wonderful leader of SNCC at one point, who now is a big, big, I won't say apologist, but a strong supporter of Obama and trying to make linkages between Obama and Dr. King. And Obama is never going to lead a poor people's campaign. He doesn't give a damn for the poor people. He doesn't know. His whole experience is so different. I'm sorry he's black, because I think possibly that has been a restraining force on criticism. People, liberals, whatever they want to call themselves, will not criticize him, in part because whatever you want to call it, political correctness or something. But he, of all the presidents, and I also don't have very much a strong feeling for Bill Clinton with his whole Robert Rubin, Larry Summers deregulation crowd and the destruction of Glass-Steagall. Clinton has done more for the corporate system than all the Republicans around, including Reagan. So the Democrats really, I wish there were some kind of real alternative.
There is a connection, though, I believe, between Martin Luther King and President Obama, and that is this. They both mm-hmm. won Nobel Prizes for peace. Now imagine today a real-life scenario. Martin Luther King goes to in front of the White House to ask for the apartheid regime. The largest prison in the world is in Gaza, and that to be recognized and stated, call it what it is, call it an apartheid regime, and stop funding it. And then you would suddenly have all of the major federal agencies targeting King now as a terrorist.
Because, right.
And so you'd have one, and here's the irony, isn't it irony? You'd have one African-American who won the Nobel Peace Prize, targeting another because of his statements about peace. That is the irony, and that is the only association they have, and they shouldn't be mentioned together. Because King was a true champion of all people, not just African Americans. He had the courage to stand up against the militarization of our society. He was adamantly against the Vietnam War, and yet Obama has not been, and yet he got into power because he pretended to be against the war in Iraq. And yet I went back and I studied his background. I studied where did he actually become a social activist, and I can't find that. I found just the opposite. He and Valerie Jarrett were part of a team that actually worked with the developers, the real estate developers in Chicago, to help get them the parcels of land and the buildings in their control to make it more profitable. He was selected by Miss Pritzker, a billionaire, long before he was elected, and that's true of many. Bill Clinton the same way. You are selected and groomed before you are elected, and how they polish you, how they give you the image that is populist is just amazing. That brings me to my final question for you, and that is, when you look at the American media, it's the media that has the power to determine our perceptions of people. And you look at the creating of a national fascism would only be able to occur in the light of a Fox or MSNBC or the New York Times and Judith Miller. And the idea of flattening personal diversity, a belief in social opinions. Wasn't it Mussolini who said fascist education is moral, physical, social, military? It aims to create a complete and harmoniously developed human, a fascist one according to our views. In other words, in the fascist worldview, the population must become a single automaton that works as a unified entity on behalf of the nation. And my great concern is that American entertainment and our major media are priming people for embracing this kind of unified worldview with America as supreme and with no other allowance for protest or dissent. Your final thoughts?
My final thought is that what we're living through is a very real shrinkage of the political ideological spectrum. And what we see as centrism today, what we are witnessing as centrism today, would have been already well on the right 20 years ago. And this is going further and further. And what I feel is sad, and I have no right to feel this because I have not been active as I think I should, that radicalism has not responded well enough, that in so many ways, I don't even know what the depth of the feeling is, but there is an accommodation to power, and in terms of what is it that gives the country that kind of oh, I don't know, let's for the moment, I won't call it sadness because unfortunately there is no sadness there, but I think that military power itself, even not used, even merely the huge budgets, the presence, the flyovers at the football games, the whatever it takes, that militarism and what I've been calling the militarization of capitalism itself, that militarism has become a kind of restraining force. I think we're not admitting it to ourselves, but I think we're all a little bit looking over the shoulder, and we're all a little bit scared. And those wonderful, wonderful civil rights demonstrations of the 60s, and things you see around the world now in some countries and in Brazil and other countries, it's terribly exciting. And I think we've just simply fallen away. So what can I say, Gary, except to thank you so much for giving me this chance and to be part of all of this?
I would like to see radicalism in the media, but you will not see it on MSNBC. You will not see it in many of the publications. What you see is a form of homogenized, pasteurized liberalism supporting a corporate entity, but with the right to speak out or write out occasionally in a way that makes it seem and pretend as if it is a counterbalance, and it is not. And I see it on radio, a very popular morning radio program. It's it supports neoliberalism, even as it challenges it. And I see this all the time. We need those voices. And thank you very much for being there and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thanks so much, Gary. Goodbye.
Goodbye. That was Professor Norman Pollack, Professor Emeritus of History at Michigan State, and one of the most important true progressives in our country's history. You can follow his work. He's a graduate of Harvard and taught at Yale. He writes for counterpunch.org. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.